You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 121, The Red Danube. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. Without you, the show would not be viable. And as always, I'd like to invite the rest of you to join us on Patreon. I just published the 30th of our bonus episodes, which included topics like the ski troops of the Norwegian Jaeger Corps and mercenaries during the Napoleonic Wars. I even got to talk about one of my favorite novels, The Count of Monte Cristo. You can get access to it and all 30 bonus episodes for just $2 a month. You also get ad-free versions of the regular episodes. And of course, contributing on Patreon is the single best way to support the show. If you appreciate what I do, I hope you'll consider it. Anyway, we left off last time in late April 1809. The long-anticipated War of the Fifth Coalition had finally broken out. In the main theater of the war, in southern Germany, things had started well for the Austrians, with Archduke Charles leading an army into French-aligned Bavaria. The French response was sluggish. They had been taken by surprise, and Napoleon himself was not yet at the front. However, once the emperor arrived, it hadn't taken long for him to turn the tables. The French and their German allies won a series of victories in quick succession. The Battle of Teugenhausen on April 19th, Abensberg on the 20th, Landshut on the 21st, Eckmühl on the 22nd, and Ratisbon on the 23rd. None of these battles has really gone down in history. These are not the names you see when you look over a list of Napoleon's great battlefield triumphs. But the cumulative effect of 5 victories in 5 days was almost as significant as that of a single great battle. The Austrian offensive, which had started with such promise, was stopped dead. Archduke Charles had lost somewhere around 40,000 men in less than a week. Those who remained had barely escaped destruction. They were in full retreat and had been forced to leave behind much of their supplies and equipment. In fact, the situation of the Austrian army was even worse than it looked at first glance. Most of the Archduke's forces had been forced to retreat north of the Danube River. Bonaparte's next objective would be the capital, Vienna. If they hoped to oppose him, Archduke Charles and most of his army were now on the wrong side of one of Europe's largest rivers. Napoleon was supremely confident. In a bulletin to the Grande Armée, he told his soldiers, quote, "In 1 month, we will be in Vienna," end quote. In fact, by this stage in the campaign, Napoleon might have been a bit overconfident. He had described his recent victories over Archduke Charles as a second Jena, comparing the situation to his triumph over the Prussians back in 1806. As you might remember from those episodes, after their defeats at Jena and Auerstedt, the Prussian army had nearly disintegrated. Huge Prussian formations of tens of thousands of men had agreed to become prisoners without a fight. Not only the Prussian military, but the entire country had seemed consumed by a sense of futility and doom. Things were very different in Austria in the spring of 1809. Spirits were not high within Archduke Charles's army, to say the least, but they were still ready to fight. They were certainly aware they had gotten a bad bloody nose in the first phase of the war, but they were already thinking of the next battle. There was no talk of surrendering to the French en masse. Jena and Auerstedt had shaken the Prussian state to its very foundations. The same could not be said of the Austrian defeats of early 1809. Napoleon dispatched Third Corps under Marshal Davout to the north to shadow Archduke Charles and the main body of the Austrian field army on their retreat into Bohemia. He wanted to maintain the pressure on Charles, to keep him from interfering with the drive on Vienna. Other units were deployed to guard the southern flank and to maintain the lines of communication back to France. The rest of the Grande Armée would drive straight for the Austrian capital. They would not be completely unopposed. As you might remember from last episode, part of the Austrian army had fled Bavaria to the east rather than the north, a single corps under Baron Johann von Hiller. The Baron gathered together stragglers from other units and reserves, and pulled regiments from garrison duty, and was able to throw together a force of nearly 50,000 men. This was nowhere near enough to seriously challenge Napoleon in a major battle, but Hiller would try to at least delay the French, maybe by enough time to organize a proper defense of the capital. The Austrians were able to fight several rearguard actions. Most of these were small and not terribly successful, but there was one of note, the Battle of Ebelsburg, fought on May 3, 1809. The town of Ebelsburg included valuable bridges over the Traun River. Hiller decided to fortify it and make the French fight for a crossing. His units soon made contact with troops from 4th Corps of the Grande Armée under Marshal Masséna. Ebelsburg certainly wasn't a major city, even by early 19th century standards, but it was a large, prosperous town. There were a lot of stone and brick buildings and garden walls. The town was dominated by a large medieval castle. This was a very formidable position. Hiller had chosen his ground well. However, Masséna ordered an immediate frontal assault to take the town by storm. There was bitter fighting at close quarters. The two forces were of roughly equivalent size, but the buildings of the town gave the Austrian defenders an incredible advantage. The first French attacks were too small and made only limited progress, but as the day wore on, Masséna was able to pour more and more troops into the fight, and the momentum slowly shifted towards the French. But it was hard going. They had to clear Ebelsburg street by street, and even building by building. The Austrians tried to counterattack, but these assaults were poorly coordinated. Habsburg units attacked piecemeal, and now the shoe was on the other foot. They were the ones who would have to clear out those imposing stone buildings if they hoped to push the French out of the town. Many historians have criticized Baron Hiller's leadership. A more capable commander would have made better use of this strong position, and not thrown away so many men in pointless, uncoordinated counterattacks. The battle did seem to be going Masséna's way, but his progress was agonizingly slow. That castle was a particularly hard nut to crack. The attackers had to send forward their sappers, combat engineers, who specialized in demolishing enemy fortifications, to tear down the castle gate with axes while under fire from the enemy. Once the castle fell, it became clear to Baron Hiller that Ebelsburg was lost. He ordered his artillery to open fire on the town with exploding ammunition, hoping to set it on fire. It worked. The French advance was slowed as the flames spread, and the town was thrown into chaos. Soldiers from both sides, who were too badly wounded to escape, burned in the inferno. The Austrian horsemen were able to screen their retreat from the battlefield, and the day was mercifully over. It had been a bloody affair. Both sides had started with somewhere between 20 and 30,000 men. Casualty estimates vary, but the French lost somewhere between 3,500 and 6,000 soldiers. Austrian casualties were slightly worse, somewhere between 4,500 and 8,000. The Battle of Ebelsburg is all the more tragic because it was totally unnecessary. Early on the morning of the battle, the 2nd Corps of the Grande Armée, under Marshal Lannes, had already crossed the Traun River several miles to the south. If Masséna had simply waited, Baron Hiller would have gotten word that he was in danger of being trapped by Lannes' advance and withdrawn from the town without a fight. Napoleon rebuked Masséna, but the stubborn, white-haired marshal maintained that the attack was still justified, to prevent Hiller from escaping to the north and joining Archduke Charles. Bonaparte and Masséna could work together effectively, but they found it impossible to get along on a personal level. None of the skirmishes and small battles in this phase of the war succeeded in seriously delaying Napoleon's advance. The Austrian troops were fighting relatively well, but under these circumstances, there was simply no way to stem the tide. Napoleon entered Vienna on May 13, 1809. There was no fight for the capital. The garrison agreed to give up after the French set up artillery batteries in the outskirts and threatened to bombard the city center. Napoleon had promised his troops they would be in Vienna within a month. It had only taken about 2 weeks. In fact, it had only been a little over a month since the war began. It had all started so well for the Habsburgs, but only a month later, Napoleon was sleeping in Emperor Francis's bed. How quickly things can change. However, despite this stunning success, Bonaparte now found himself at an impasse. He had hoped seizing Vienna would be enough to end the war. That might sound like wishful thinking, but the capital was incredibly important in the Austrian system. There was precedent for a threat to Vienna leading them to sue for peace. Remember, this is how Napoleon himself had brought the War of the First Coalition to a close 12 years earlier. But as of this moment, there was no indication the Austrians were interested in peace. Archduke Charles and their main field army may have been in retreat, but he still had over 100,000 men in good order. We'll discuss this in future episodes, but Austrian forces on other fronts were actually experiencing success. The state had the resources to keep fighting, and its leaders intended to do so. Napoleon had actually been in a similar position before, back in 1805. The War of the Third Coalition had started with the French stopping, then driving back, an Austrian offensive into southern Germany, then rapidly advancing through the western regions of the Habsburg Empire to seize Vienna. Back in 1805, the coalition forces had given up the capital without a fight and fallen back across the Danube into Bohemia. Napoleon had followed them into Bohemia, tricked them into attacking him at Austerlitz, and, as they say, the rest is history. And so, with the Grande Armée in Vienna and Archduke Charles in Bohemia, you might think the obvious next step would be to follow that 1805 playbook and try for another Austerlitz. However, that would be much more difficult in 1809. You might remember that back in 1805, the French had seized a bridge over the Danube intact, with a truly absurd bit of bluffing. The Austrians had not made the same mistake this time around. When the Vienna garrison retreated from the capital, they had blown up all the bridges over the Danube behind them. Shortly after securing Vienna, Napoleon dispatched a small force across the Danube by boat to establish a beachhead on the far bank. If the French could get a good foothold, building new bridges would be easy, and the advance could continue. On May 13th, the same day the Emperor himself arrived in Vienna, 1,000 light infantry from Marshal Lannes' corps made the crossing at a place called Schwarze Lachenau. Unfortunately for the French, this movement was detected almost immediately by a group of Landwehr, the new Austrian militia founded by Archduke Charles. The experienced, well-trained voltigeurs were able to rout them very quickly, but the alarm had been raised. Soon, regular Habsburg troops were on the scene. They were able to work their way around the French flank and threaten their only means of escape. The voltigeurs disintegrated. Out of the 1,000 French soldiers who crossed the Danube at Schwarze Lachenau, only about 300 made it back. Austrian casualties were only 300, and about half of those were poorly trained militiamen, who, to be blunt, the Habsburgs could afford to lose. This probably should have been taken as a warning, or at the very least a reminder of the difficulties and potential dangers of a river crossing. However, Napoleon remained determined to bridge the Danube and bring the main body of his army into Bohemia. Several of his marshals and generals objected. The Grande Armée was not in a favorable position. They had advanced deep into Austrian territory very quickly, on a relatively narrow front. If you were to draw the areas under French occupation on a map, you would see a long, thin line from the Bavarian border to Vienna, stretching about 280 kilometers, or about 174 miles. There were significant hostile forces on both sides of this line, and a restive population inside. Tens of thousands of French troops were already tied up just maintaining and defending this tenuous position. This meant Napoleon's main field army was now dramatically smaller than the force that had won so many victories in Bavaria only a few weeks earlier. If they crossed into Bohemia, they would be sticking their necks out even further. And that was on top of the inherent tactical difficulties of achieving a river crossing, especially given that the French did not actually know very much about the Austrian forces that awaited them on the other side. Napoleon believed Archduke Charles was deeper into Bohemia, somewhere around Brünn, which had been his own base of operations at Austerlitz. But this was not certain, and the fighting at Schwarzenlachenau had proved there was at least some significant body of Austrian regulars ready to respond to a French crossing. Napoleon thought he could mitigate the risk by crossing in force, building a temporary bridge overnight, and bringing entire divisions over the river quickly, rather than relying on a small number of light infantry to establish a beachhead by boat. The engineers of the Grande Armée identified several possible sites for such an attack. The emperor and his staff picked a location just downstream of Vienna, where there was an island in the river called Lobau. So the French would actually need to build two bridges, one from the Vienna side of the river to the island of Lobau, and one from Lobau to the far bank. But this was actually an advantage. It shortened the total distance they would have to span. The island of Lobau was very close to the far bank, meaning the second and most important bridge would be very short. The French would be able to use the island as a staging area in case they encountered serious resistance. And perhaps most importantly, if the Austrians chose to contest the crossing, they would doubtlessly try to destroy the French bridges. In the early 19th century, this was usually done by going upstream of the bridge and sending unmanned barges down the river, loaded down with rocks or junk or debris to make them heavy, and sometimes set on fire, so they would collide with the bridge, hopefully damaging or destroying it. The first bridge, from Vienna to Lobau, would be vulnerable to this technique, but the all-important second bridge, from Lobau to the far bank, would not, because the island was only separated from the far bank by a very narrow channel, away from the main central current of the Danube. It was not a bad plan, but there was simply no way to conduct an operation like this one without some major risks. No matter how the French managed their crossing, there would inevitably be a period of time in which only a fraction of the army would be across the Danube. Until the rest of the army crossed, and the beachhead could be expanded, those first units on the far bank would be vulnerable, in enemy territory with their backs to the river. Bonaparte was unconcerned. If the operation was well planned and conducted with urgency, that period of vulnerability could be greatly reduced. And besides, he hoped to have tens of thousands of men across the Danube that first night. Even if the Austrians did attack, such a large force would likely be able to hold their own until reinforcements arrived. The proposed beachhead on the far side of the river would be highly defensible, anchored on both flanks by large towns, Aspern to the west and Essling to the east, and behind them a large bend in the river, creating a relatively secure triangle of land, which the French could use as a base. These types of operations were never a sure thing, but the plan was sound. If the French were going to attempt this dangerous maneuver, this was a good way to go about it. Still, much of the leadership of the Grande Armée remained opposed to a crossing. The risks were simply too great. The war was going well for France. Why put the army in such jeopardy? However, there were risks to inaction as well. As we've discussed, the rapid advance of the Grande Armée had left its flanks exposed. The Habsburg forces were regrouping and uniting. Austrian armies on other fronts were advancing. As long as the war continued, there was the risk the Prussians might join in. You could easily make the argument that a bold attack aimed at winning the war in a single stroke was actually the safest course of action. As you might imagine, given his character, Napoleon came down on this side of the debate. In fact, he thought all this caution and preparation would be for nothing. He believed the Austrian military was on the brink of collapse and would be unable and unwilling to contest the crossing in any serious way. And so the date was set. After nightfall on May 19, 1809, the engineers would begin building the bridges. The Grande Armée would cross the Danube, sweep into Bohemia, force the enemy into a major battle, destroy their main field army, and win the war, just as they had done back in 1805. Building the first bridge turned out to be far more difficult than anyone had imagined. The Danube is an incredibly powerful river, especially at this time of the year, swollen by melting snow in the mountains and heavy rains on the plain. The engineers were forced to take shortcuts just to get the bridge up in time. Finally, after hours of fits and starts, and constant furious activity, supervised by the Emperor himself, the first French troops were marching across the bridges. It was an incredible achievement by the army's engineers, but their work was nowhere near over. The constant stream of men, horses, cannons, and wagons put a lot of strain on the bridges. They needed constant maintenance just to stay upright. The engineers would be working almost around the clock for the next 3 days. A French soldier would later recall, quote, "Everyone worked. Officers and generals were in the water almost up to their necks," end quote. The problems with the bridges became worse on May 20th, when the Austrians became aware of the crossing and started sending barges loaded with ballast downriver to damage the first bridge. One of these nearly succeeded in destroying it, setting back Napoleon's timetable by hours. Despite these difficulties, the operation did appear to be succeeding. By evening on the 20th, most of Marshal Massena's 4th Corps was across the Danube, and had taken possession of the key towns of Aspern and Essling with barely any effort. A significant portion of the cavalry under Marshal Bessières had arrived as well. They were busy scouting the area north of the beachhead. In total, there were over 20,000 French troops on the far bank. The Austrians had made only token resistance with the small number of men who had been left to garrison this area. Bessières' horsemen had discovered no significant enemy formations in the area. It seemed Napoleon was right and his most cautious commanders were wrong. Only Marshal Massena persisted in his doubts, insisting the Austrians must be close. The cavalry hadn't found the enemy army yet, but that didn't mean it wasn't somewhere nearby. But as you know, Massena and Napoleon often butted heads. Perhaps the Emperor assumed the white-haired marshal was just being difficult and contrarian. Once they had secured the area around Aspern and Essling, the French did little to expand their beachhead. There was some logic to this. The area was highly defensible. There was no similar position to be found further to the north. They were alarmingly close to the river, but it didn't seem like the Austrians would attack anyway. A French general wrote in a letter to his wife, quote, "The enemy made but a feeble resistance. In camp, everyone asks, where are they?" End quote. Through the night, French troops continued crossing the Danube. Dawn broke on May 21st, much as it had on the 20th, a constant thrum of activity in the French lines. More and more men crossing the bridges, and no sign of the enemy. The Austrians launched more barges against the first bridge, and once again succeeded in knocking it out of commission. The French engineers swarmed over the bridge, desperately repairing it, while the bulk of the Grande Armée milled around on the south bank, eagerly awaiting their turn to cross. By now there were about 25,000 French troops across the river. As the day wore on, the wind picked up, kicking up dust from the fields around Aspern and Essling. Soon, a thick layer of dust clung to the ground, almost like a fog. At around 1 p.m, white-jacketed Austrian troops suddenly emerged from the haze and attacked the advanced outposts of Massena's corps, just north of the town of Aspern, which anchored Napoleon's left flank. The Battle of Aspern-Essling had begun. The French were surprised and fell back towards the town with little resistance. More and more Austrian troops began to emerge from the clouds of dust and formed up outside Aspern. Napoleon had miscalculated, and his cavalry scouts had failed him. Archduke Charles had arrived with his entire field army. He had waited for the French to get a significant portion of their force across the river, with the aim of crushing the enemy beachhead and forcing Bonaparte back over the Danube. Napoleon had practically written off the Habsburg military, believing they were near collapse after his victories the previous month. Now he was about to face one of the greatest tests of his entire career. There was nothing complicated about the Austrian battle plan. Under these conditions, there was no room for fancy maneuvers or clever strategy. If the French could hold on to Aspern and Essling along their left and right flank, the beachhead would probably hold. If the Austrians were able to secure one or both of these towns, they stood a good chance of crushing a significant portion of the Grande Armée against the Danube, much as Napoleon had done to the Russians on the banks of the Aale at Friedland 1.5 years earlier. Archduke Charles would put most of his strength into the attack on Aspern, hoping to secure the village, then push into the French left, ideally cutting off or at least threatening their access to the temporary bridge from Lobau Island. The French were surprised. They had not been expecting an attack, and the combination of the dust storm and the gentle slope down to the river had enabled the Habsburg forces to advance almost all the way to the French lines without being detected. As the white-jacketed columns marched forward to the attack, Emperor Francis himself appeared to offer them one last salute. The regimental bands struck up Austria's relatively new national anthem, "God Save Emperor Francis," and the men cheered raucously. A German soldier fighting for Napoleon would later recall, quote, "The enemy advanced to battle as if on a grand parade. The men had thrown their greatcoats over their shoulders, and their bands played constantly. We saw the flags with the double eagle waving cheerfully." End quote. This did not look like an army on the brink of collapse. The initial assault on Aspern would be resisted by a single infantry division from Massena's corps, led by General Gabriel Jean-Joseph Molitor, an extremely experienced and capable officer who had served under Massena for years. He would eventually rise to the rank of marshal. There was desperate fighting as the Austrians attacked Aspern. Because the French had not been expecting an attack, their units were spread out, not concentrated for battle. Archduke Charles was throwing several entire corps at the village, attacking from three sides. Molitor didn't even have his whole division stationed in the village to hold them off. Fortunately for the French, Aspern was an incredibly strong position. Lots of stone and brick buildings and walls, and clear fields of fire on every side. A Habsburg officer would later recall, quote, "We thought we had before us a simple village garrisoned by infantry, but found a fortress that we had to storm without first creating a breach." End quote. The Austrians suffered terrible casualties, but they had the manpower to just keep throwing soldiers at the town. Molitor's troops were able to hold them off, and the general concentrated his forces. Soon, the entire division was defending Aspern. This was bad news for the Austrians. Had they been able to storm the town before the French were ready, they might have won a quick, easy victory. Now they were faced with the prospect of tough urban combat against over 6,000 French infantry. They still had a significant numerical advantage, but the terrain would do a lot to even the odds. This would be a hard fight. The Habsburg forces had a massive advantage in artillery. Napoleon had not been able to bring very many guns over the river, and Archduke Charles had arranged his cannons well, mostly in one huge battery on the heights that rose up from the river. The Austrian gunners had an excellent vantage point, and were concentrated enough to do some serious damage. They pummeled Aspern. Within a few hours, many of the buildings were on fire. Still, the French held on, sometimes firing out of the first floor while the roof above them burned. They made the Austrians fight for every street and every building. There are even accounts of firefights between French and Austrian troops inside the buildings of Aspern, with a small French firing line on one side of a large room and an Austrian firing line only a few paces away on the other side. In this desperate fighting, the leadership of General Molitor and Marshal Massena was indispensable. Both men seemed to be everywhere at once, showing no fear and leading from the front. Massena even picked up a musket and started blasting away at the Austrians himself, just like a common soldier. One of Massena's troops would later write that the marshal, quote, inspired all around him with irresistible strength, end quote. In the thick of the fighting, one of Massena's generals tracked him down to tell the marshal his troops were wavering. His command was made up mostly of fresh conscripts. This was a very unfortunate way for them to be getting their first taste of battle. Perhaps understandably, they were terrified. Massena told him, quote, get them drunk and show them the flag, end quote. Smaller attacks were underway all along the line. The Austrians made little progress on the right flank. This part of the French line was also anchored on a village, Essling. It was slightly smaller, but just as formidable a position as Aspern on the left. However, here too the fighting picked up late in the afternoon. The French outposts were pushed back, and soon troops led by Marshal Lannes were fighting in the village itself, just like their comrades at Aspern at the other end of the line. The Habsburg forces here were not as strong, but still the combat was intense. Just like at Aspern, the Austrian artillery managed to set fire to the town, adding a hellish quality to the fighting. There was not as much action in the center, which was good news for the French because Napoleon had been forced to deploy almost all his infantry to defend those two villages. The French center was held mostly by cavalry, which, as you know, was not as effective fighting on the defensive. Still, the French horsemen suffered terribly from enemy artillery fire, and had to make several charges both to their left and their right to relieve the pressure on those two towns. Some of these charges were quite substantial. At one point, the cuirassier general Jean-Louis d'Espagne led forward 7,000 horsemen against the Austrian troops around Aspern. An eyewitness to the charge would later recall, quote, with no regard for the monstrous numerical superiority that stood against them, they fell upon the enemy with rare determination. End quote. Many of the Austrian units were relatively new, and even many of their older regiments were dominated by fresh recruits, brought in to replace the horrible losses of the last three wars. Some had seen combat in the first phase of the war, but they were generally inexperienced and not always reliable. Archduke Charles did not trust them to form and hold a square formation, one of the most difficult battlefield maneuvers expected of Napoleonic soldiers. And so, Charles had changed Habsburg doctrine. Rather than relying on the square, when threatened by cavalry, Austrian units were supposed to get into a formation called the Massed Battalion. Essentially a solid column, but with the men on the edges facing outwards rather than forwards. The theory was that this would be easier to form than a square under the pressure of combat, and that the men would be a bit more steady with a solid mass behind them, rather than the empty space at the center of a traditional square. Of course, the big drawback was that the vast majority of the unit would be inside that solid center, and unable to engage advancing enemy cavalry, the firepower that made squares so deadly to charging horsemen would be greatly reduced. This new formation had not been tested on any significant scale before the Battle of Aspern-Essling. No one in the Austrian leadership could be sure that it would work as they had practiced on the parade ground. It turned out to be surprisingly effective. As the French cavalry advanced, the Austrian assault columns formed their battalion masses, and the formations held. The attack was stopped, and Habsburg units did suffer casualties, but not a single regiment broke. Archduke Charles then ordered his own cavalry forward to counter the French, and a fierce melee ensued. At this point, General d'Espagne was struck. Sources differ by what. It was either a cannonball or a cavalryman's saber. His troopers rushed him to a hospital in the rear, but he would be dead before sundown. d'Espagne's cavalry eventually fell back, but they succeeded in relieving the pressure on Aspern. Unfortunately for the French, it was only a temporary respite. As soon as the charge receded, the Austrians reformed their assault columns and renewed the attack on the village. The fighting inside Aspern was some of the most brutal urban combat we've covered on this show. A real brawl, fought mostly at close range, or even hand-to-hand. The environment itself was something out of Dante's Inferno. A French officer would later recall, quote, "We were soon wrapped in thick clouds of black smoke, through which the sun, low on the horizon, shone like a blood-red globe of fire, giving a crimson hue to the whole landscape." End quote. Control of Aspern seesawed back and forth for hours. The Austrians would pour more men into the town. They would make good progress, sometimes seemingly on the verge of completely evicting their enemies from the position. Then, somehow, Massena would find the strength for a counterattack, and retake some or all of the town, and the process would repeat. An Austrian officer described the combat, quote, "Every house, every tree, every fence was defended by the enemy and had to be won separately. We fought in every house, in every barn. Wagons, plows, and harrows had to be cleared away to get at the enemy. Every little wall was an obstacle for the attackers and a protection for the defenders. And we had hardly seized an alley or house when the enemy stormed a different one and forced us to leave what we had taken." End quote. Archduke Charles decided to concentrate his forces for a big, coordinated attack to finally break the stalemate. He led them forward himself, and they finally succeeded in pushing the French out of the town. The worst had happened. Massena began gathering forces for an immediate counterattack. If he could dislodge the Austrians before they had time to ensconce themselves in the town, there was still a chance to stave off disaster. Fortunately for the French, he had been reinforced, and now had several units from his other divisions, to supplement the battered remains of General Molitor's division. But this was an act of desperation. Even with these reinforcements, the French were outnumbered 5-1. And now the Austrians would be fighting on the defensive, with all the advantages of that urban terrain on their side. However, despite the odds, Massena's counterattack succeeded. Most of the village fell to the French once again. The astonished Habsburg troops were only able to hold on to a few outlying buildings. The beachhead was saved, at least for the moment. Unfortunately for everyone, sunset comes late in Austria this time of year, well after 8 p.m. Fierce combat continued all along the line, well into the evening. As the sun finally set, the battlefield was lit only by the low red glow of burning buildings. The fighting began to die down. The action never did completely stop. The two lines were so close together that soldiers continued taking pot shots at each other through the night, especially inside Aspern, where some of the combatants were only separated by a few paces. It had been a hellish day for all involved, especially for the soldiers who had fought inside Aspern. This was Napoleonic combat at its most desperate, up close and personal, surrounded by burning buildings and charred ruins. With the battle going back and forth over the same ground so many times, the whole area was overflowing with the wounded and the dead. A French officer described having to climb over heaps of bodies to enter the town. By some estimates, aspirin had changed hands 6 times. On the French side, the men of General Molitor's division were the heroes of the day. Their bravery and toughness had saved the beachhead. They had paid a terrible price. Around half had been killed or wounded. And remember, the fighting had only lasted half the day. Archduke Charles hadn't launched his attack until the early afternoon. Neither army left its positions after nightfall. There was every indication the carnage would continue the next morning. In fact, both sides were using this nighttime lull to concentrate more of their forces. May 22nd was shaping up to be even bloodier than May 21st. Napoleon brought in tens of thousands of reinforcements, the bulk of Marshal Lannes' Second Corps, plus the Imperial Guard. The Imperial Guard of the Battle of Aspern-Essling was a somewhat different force from the one we've come to know over the course of this show. As you may remember from our recent episodes on the war in Iberia, many of the Guard's oldest and most celebrated regiments were in Spain. They were engaged in combat operations. They couldn't simply be pulled out of the line when Napoleon left Iberia to face the Habsburg threat. And so the Imperial Guard at Aspern-Essling was made up largely of newer units, the so-called Middle Guard, which had been formed in 1806, and the Young Guard, which were brand new regiments formed for this campaign. The Middle Guard was not quite on the same level as the original units of the Imperial Guard, but it included a lot of veteran soldiers. On the other hand, the men of the Young Guard were mostly fresh conscripts. These were still elite units. They were well-trained, well-led, and got their pick of the best recruits. But many would be seeing battle for the first time. They were an unknown quantity. Marshal Davout and his veteran Third Corps were supposed to cross next, but conditions would not cooperate. The first bridge broke again, and the engineers were not able to repair it before morning. Still, as dawn approached, Napoleon now had over 70,000 men packed into that beachhead on the north bank of the Danube. Crucially, all the units that had seen heavy action on the 21st were rotated out of the French line, replaced by fresh regiments, and added to the reserve. The Austrians still had numerical superiority. Archduke Charles had brought up reinforcements as well. When the battle restarted, he would be able to call upon nearly 100,000 men. The first rays of morning sun had not yet appeared when the fighting began again on May 22, 1809. It started in the town of Aspern. No surprise, there had been sporadic firing in this area throughout the night. The two sides had simply been too close together to rest easy. The French launched a major attack before dawn. The Austrians were taken by surprise and lost a good deal of ground before they were able to pull themselves together and hold firm. It seemed like they would fight off the attack. Then they were hit by a second wave, which succeeded in securing the town. Meanwhile, on Napoleon's right flank, the Austrians launched another attack on Essling. There was intense fighting, but they were unable to push into the town. The first few hours of combat had gone well for the Grande Armée. Napoleon's flanks were under pressure once again, but both towns were holding. Now that he had received significant reinforcements, Bonaparte could finally think about turning the tables and seizing the initiative. Ever since his troops first made contact with the Austrians the previous afternoon, Napoleon had been forced to react to their movements. Now he was finally in a position to make Archduke Charles react to him. So far, almost all the action had been focused on the two flanks. It wasn't hard to see why. The Austrians had dictated the course of the battle, and from their perspective, the villages of Aspern and Essling were obviously the keys to the French position. An attack into Napoleon's center would be pointless, as long as these two strong positions remained in French hands. But the French had no such constraints. Napoleon surmised that with so much attention focused on the flanks, the Austrian center would be weak. He planned to launch a major offensive in this sector. If the French could punch through that weakened center, the Austrian army would be split in two, and both flanks would suddenly be threatened with encirclement. If the attack was successful, Archduke Charles would have to abandon the attacks on Aspern and Essling, at least temporarily, until he could answer this threat. He might even be forced to retreat from the battlefield. It might sound too good to be true, but it was sound logic. If the Emperor was right and the assault succeeded, this debacle could easily become a great success. This would not be the first time Napoleon had suddenly changed the course of a battle with a bold attack. The French army had been in even worse straits 10 years earlier at Marengo, before General Desaix's assault suddenly turned the tide. And so, over 10,000 French infantry began massing for the attack on the Austrian center. They would be led by Marshal Lannes himself and two of the army's best divisional commanders, General Saint-Hilaire, a charismatic and well-liked veteran officer who had helped lead the key advance up the Pratzen Heights at Austerlitz, and General Oudinot, an almost unbelievably courageous leader who would be wounded in action 34 times before the end of his career. The men cried out, "Long live the Emperor," as the drummers beat out the signal to advance. It must have felt good to finally be on the offensive after nearly a full 24 hours of desperate defense. As the assault columns came within view of the Austrian lines, they came under punishing cannon fire. As I mentioned earlier, the Habsburg artillery was very well positioned, mostly in one big battery along a low ridge line overlooking the center of the battlefield. Those columns of blue-jacketed French infantry were marching almost straight towards them in their neat, tightly packed formations, perfect targets for solid shot. The Austrian gunners tore bloody holes into their ranks, but they just kept coming. General Saint-Hilaire had one of his feet blown clean off by a cannonball and was rushed off the battlefield. It was a horrible wound, but it should have been easily survivable. Unfortunately, gangrene set in, and the doctors were unable to save him. He would die in a hospital in Vienna a few weeks later. As the French approached the Habsburg lines, the Austrian infantry wavered. Napoleon's assessment had been entirely correct. With the Archduke focused on the two flanks, his center was very weak. A French officer described the scene, quote, "Marshal Lannes advanced bravely over the plain. Nothing could stand in his way. In one instance, he captured a whole battalion, a standard, and 5 guns. The Austrians fell back with regularity, but their center, being compelled to extend as we advanced further, finished by breaking. Disorder set in among the enemy troops, to such a degree that we could see their officers and sergeants beating their men with sticks without being able to keep them in their ranks." End quote. It seemed the Emperor had done it again. His army had been caught in perhaps the most unfavorable position imaginable, but now, somehow, in spite of the odds, the French were on the cusp of victory. Perhaps Napoleon really was unbeatable. But Archduke Charles still had one move left to make. In fact, it was something he had borrowed from Napoleon's own playbook. Many of the best Austrian troops were held in reserve. Charles had taken the grenadier companies from many of his best regiments and put them all together in a special reserve division, held back from the front line. As you might recall from earlier episodes, the grenadiers were something of an elite, the biggest and most courageous man of each infantry regiment, who specialized in assaults and close-quarter fighting. This grenadier division formed a special elite reserve, much like Napoleon's Imperial Guard. As the French began to advance up the gentle slope towards the Austrian guns, the grenadier division launched a counterattack. The grenadiers tended to be big men, and their size was accentuated by their tall bearskin hats. It must have made the man out in front, leading the charge, look even smaller by comparison. It was Archduke Charles himself, thin and short, even by the standards of early 19th century Europe. The Archduke had picked up the flag of the Von Zach Regiment, bright yellow with a colorful border adorned with the black double-headed eagle, which had been the symbol of his family's domains for centuries. In the first phase of the war, Charles hadn't looked terribly impressive, but at Aspern Essling, he was like a god of war, managing the army with incredible skill and displaying personal bravery to boot, leading from the front on several occasions. Charles would later deny carrying the flag himself. When someone asked him about this years later, he told them, quote, "You know how heavy flags are. Do you think a little fellow like me could have made off with one of them?" End quote. However, several eyewitnesses describe seeing him carrying the flag, so perhaps he was just being modest. In any case, caught by surprise and battered by the Habsburg artillery, the French were unable to hold. The assault force began to drift backwards. Ideally, there would have been a second wave from Marshal Davout's Third Corps to back them up and maintain the momentum, but they were still on the wrong side of the river, thanks to all the problems with the bridge. In desperation, Napoleon called forward the only forces he had available, Marshal Bessières' cavalry. They had seen heavy action the previous day, but they still found the strength to charge multiple times. There was intense fighting, but it was no use. The white-jacketed grenadiers held firm. The attack could not be salvaged. The French fell back to their starting positions. It had been a valiant effort, and had nearly succeeded in turning the tide of the battle, but in the end, all they had to show for their struggle was hundreds of casualties, including one of the Grande Armée's bravest and most beloved divisional commanders. This was not the only bad news for the French. As the attack faltered, the bridge from Vienna to Lobau broke again. On Napoleon's left flank, the seesaw battle for Aspern continued, and Massena's corps appeared to be losing. Once again, most of the town was under Austrian control, with only a few outlying buildings still in French hands. On the right flank, the fighting inside Essling had heated up. Around the same time the assault on the Austrian center was faltering, Habsburg troops launched an attack which nearly succeeded in driving the French out of the town. The struggle for Essling centered on a huge granary, two stories tall, with heavy iron doors, barred windows, and stone walls a meter thick, that's a little over 3 feet. The building was so solidly built it proved to be impervious to artillery, a real fortress. And that was a good thing for the French, because by this point in the battle, the whole rest of the town had fallen to the Austrians. The few dozen men under siege inside the granary represented the only remaining French foothold in the town. Napoleon ordered an immediate counterattack by the young guard, those conscripts who had been deemed worthy of joining the most elite corps in the French army. Perhaps surprisingly, they lived up to their designation. There was vicious hand-to-hand fighting in the streets of Essling, but eventually the men of the Young Guard were able to evict the Austrians. Most of them were not much more than boys, seeing battle for the first time, but they fought with the toughness of old veterans. Maybe that title of Imperial Guard really meant something. Still, despite this one bright spot, in the wake of the failed attack on the Austrian center, the situation of the Grande Armée was undeniably very bad. The Young Guard were Napoleon's last reserve. He hadn't been forced to deploy all of them yet, but there were only a few fresh battalions left on the north bank of the Danube. The French had already come close to permanently losing both Aspern and Essling several times. How long until one of their counterattacks failed, and the Austrians were able to penetrate beyond the villages and threaten the bridge from Lobau. By now, the French rear was under such heavy artillery fire that Napoleon himself suffered several minor flesh wounds from pieces of flying debris or shrapnel. His aides begged him to move to a safer position, somewhere on Lobau Island, but he waved them off. Finally, the members of his personal guard threatened to lay down their arms unless he moved the headquarters to Lobau, and the emperor complied. Perhaps the situation of the Grande Armée would change if they just held on a little longer, until that first bridge could be repaired and more units could be brought into the beachhead. All of Third Corps, plus other smaller formations, were still waiting on the south bank, tens of thousands of fresh troops. But by now, it was clear that the first bridge, from Vienna to Lobau, simply could not be relied upon. The channel was too wide, the current was too strong, and the Austrians had a seemingly endless supply of heavy barges to push downriver. Napoleon surveyed the battlefield and weighed his options. For the first time in his career, he came to the conclusion the battle could not be won. He began planning to evacuate his troops from the beachhead so many of their comrades had died defending. This would be no mean feat. There was just the single bridge back to Lobau, and the Austrians were close, putting both flanks under severe pressure. Not everyone agreed with the decision. When Marshal Massena was informed of the plan, he shouted at the messenger, quote, "Go and tell the Emperor that no power on earth can force me to retreat from here, and that I will stay for 4 hours, 24 hours, forever," end quote. Another messenger arrived with more specific instructions, informing him that he was to hold his position until the orders came to fall back, and he was treated to another tirade from the Marshal, quote, "Hold? No, no, I am not holding. Tell him I am not defending at all. I am attacking. Tell him clearly that I am the one who is attacking, and that I will attack until night falls." End quote. Despite Massena's objections, Bonaparte pressed ahead with his plans. He called forward the cavalry to make one last grand charge, hoping to create the space for the French forces to begin their withdrawal from the battlefield. It worked. The battered regiments of the Grande Armée started shuffling backwards, and began a quick but orderly retreat over the bridge to the comparative safety of Lobau. Once the French cavalry charge subsided, Archduke Charles could have ordered an attack. The Grande Armée was vulnerable as it made its awkward retreat over that single bridge. But he chose to hold back. It had been a bloody few days. The Austrians were almost as devastated and exhausted as the French. Many of their units were low on ammunition. In fact, before the French retreat began, Charles himself had been debating ordering his army to fall back. And besides, the Archduke had accomplished what he set out to do. The French would stay on their side of the Danube, at least for the moment. More importantly, for the first time in history, Napoleon Bonaparte had been defeated in a major battle. The Austrians were content to bombard the French with long-range artillery fire. As you've seen over the course of this episode, the Habsburg artillery was incredibly effective in this battle, and as the French massed up to cross the bridge, they made excellent targets. One last hardship for the men of the Grande Armée to cap off 2 days of hell. Marshal Lannes was speaking to one of his brigade commanders, General Pierre Puget, when suddenly, mid-conversation, the general's head was torn off by a cannonball. Lannes and Puget had been close friends. Even for an old veteran like Lannes, this was an extremely upsetting experience. The shaken marshal wandered a short distance away, found a place to sit down, and was staring into space, trying to come to terms with what he had just seen, when he, too, was struck by a cannonball. It hit him in the leg, totally shattering one of his knees, and badly damaging the other. Lannes turned to a nearby officer and said, quote, "I am wounded. It's nothing much. Give me your hand to help me up," end quote. Obviously, he could not stand up. He was in shock, unaware of how badly he was hurt. He was quickly carried over the bridge to a field hospital on Lobau. Fortunately for Lannes, the legendary army surgeon, Dr. Dominique Jean Larry, was present and quickly went to work. The most badly damaged leg was not salvageable. Apparently, Larry conducted the amputation in under 2 minutes, an almost unbelievable feat. Then again, he had a lot of practice. When Napoleon learned his best friend was wounded, he dropped everything and rushed to the hospital. When he saw the severity of the wound, the Emperor fell to his knees beside Lannes' stretcher and threw his arms around him, with tears welling up in his eyes. He then held Lannes' hand, weeping, as the two men spoke. According to one source, Lan told Napoleon, quote, "Sire, you are losing your best friend," end quote. Marcellin Marbeau, an officer we have quoted from several times in past episodes, was a member of Lan's staff and was present for all these events. He remembered it this way, quote, "The emperor, kneeling beside the stretcher, wept as he embraced the marshal, whose blood soon stained his white wool waistcoat. The marshal felt the proof of the emperor's concern very deeply, and when the latter was obliged to go away to give the orders required for the safety of the army, he said, 'You will live, my friend, you will live.' The marshal replied, gripping his hand, 'I trust I may, if I can still be of use to France and to your majesty.'" End quote. Napoleon wept openly, out in public, where the whole army could see him. You might think letting out raw emotion like this would have diminished him in the eyes of his soldiers, but this type of display was well within the bounds of early 19th century ideals of masculinity. In this era, men were free and even encouraged to show emotion under appropriately manly circumstances, and the severe injury of a close friend in battle was certainly one of those occasions. No one would have thought less of him. In fact, after all that had happened in the past few days, Bonaparte was certainly not the only man in the Grande Armée to have shed tears over a fallen friend. As darkness fell, the last French troops crossed over to Lobau, burning the bridge behind them. Marshal Masséna made sure he was among the last to leave the north bank, as if to register one last objection to the retreat. White-jacketed Habsburg troops advanced to take up positions along the bank, returning to the status quo of 4 days earlier. An Austrian captain would later recall, quote, "Night fell, and the longest, most frightful day of our lives finally came to an end. Hardly were the pickets posted when everyone ran to the blood-colored Danube to quench their burning thirst," end quote. Only a few days earlier, the French had been dreaming of a second Austerlitz. Instead, they had met unprecedented disaster. For the first time in its history, the Grande Armée had lost a battle. Napoleon Bonaparte had suffered the first real consequential defeat of his entire career. The fortunes of war can shift very quickly. That's all for now. Next episode, we'll discuss the aftermath of these stunning events. After all we've covered this episode, it feels wrong to close out with a French song. We should give the Austrians their due for a hard-fought victory. So I'll leave you with the song played by the bands of the Habsburg regiments as they marched into battle, "God Save Emperor Francis." A lot of you will know this song by a different name and associate it with a different country. But it was first written in praise of Emperor Francis, and, in the Napoleonic era, was very much associated with Austria. Happy New Year, and as always, thanks for listening.